Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Buffalo, Barrels, and Bourbon, the story of how Buffalo Trace Distillery became the world's most awarded distillery, by F. Paul Pakolt, narrated by Perry Daniels. Introduction. My profession is communing with spirits. Since 1989, I have formally reviewed over 30,000 of the fermented and distilled consumable liquids commonly referred to as spirits, distillates, water of life, or more scurriously, fire water, hooch, booze, sauce, or hard liquor. In addition to my subscription-only newsletter, F. Paul Pakolt's Spirit Journal, these product evaluations, sometimes with accompanying feature stories, have appeared in scores of publications over the past 3 decades. These included the New York Times Sunday Magazine, Wine Enthusiast, Playboy, Delta Sky In-Flight Magazine, Wine and Spirits, Men's Journal, Beverage Dynamics, Cheers, and many more. Wearing another of my career hats for 2 decades, I have consulted to numerous beverage companies, assisting them either in the creation of new spirit brands or helping them to revitalize old ones. In one such instance, I have turned master blender for an American whiskey portfolio, Jacob's Pardon. Then there is the spirits education hat, but on this I'll spare you the details, saving them for the next time. After plying my trade in this manner for over 30 years, I have come to many conclusions. Perhaps the most salient determination I have made is this. Of all the spirits that illuminate the galaxy of distilled potables, whiskey is my hands-down favorite. As charming as it can be, whiskey is a perplexing spirits category, one that is on occasion disconcerting and, at its most extreme, impenetrable. Yet for all its manifold complexities, every whiskey is composed of only 3 easily obtained foundational ingredients: grain, water, and yeast. After being fermented and distilled, freshly made whiskies are placed in cocoon-like barrels wherein they undergo periods of complicated metamorphosis. Once released from captivity in the aging warehouses, the world's whiskies take the international stage as the most prized and expensive of all distillates. They are the monarch butterflies of the spirits category. They can be, and frequently are, great hooch, in other words. One of whiskey's most enduring mysteries is why one can be so wildly dissimilar in character traits from another, not just from nation to nation or region to region, but even from barrel to barrel of the same batch. If all of the world's whiskies are made from but a trio of commonplace, wholly familiar ingredients, how can they differ so markedly in personality? Moreover, why are a handful of whiskey distillers more adept at the art of whiskey making than others? What are their secrets? I've been asking these questions for over 3 decades. 3 years ago, John Wiley & Sons, Incorporated, the Hoboken, New Jersey-based publisher of 2 previous books of mine, American Still Life, 2003, and A Double Scotch, 2005, contacted me, expressing an interest in backing another spirits-oriented business book. The topic choice, they said, was up to me. After some weeks of consideration, deciding between proposing another book on Scotch whiskey or one more on American whiskey, I settled on a subject that had all the earmarks of timelessness and pertinence: the meteoric rise in prominence of the Buffalo Trace Distillery in Frankfort, Kentucky. Along with a chapter and verse accounting of this distillery's emergence since before the 19th century, my other hope was to perhaps answer at least some of my queries about a few of whiskey's inherent riddles. Wiley agreed to my proposal, and the deal was struck. Upon informing the distillery operators about the project, I made arrangements to meet with their archivists to peruse their voluminous records. The top executives of Buffalo Trace at the time, namely CEO Mark Brown, Public Relations Manager Amy Preske, Master Distiller Harlan Wheatley, Master Blender Drew Mayville, and former Senior Marketing Director Chris Comstock, who departed early in 2021, have all known me long enough to know that I would allow the facts of the historical records as I unearth them to dictate the trajectory of the story, warts and all. As with American Still Life and A Double Scotch, my independence would not permit a vanity project. They acknowledged that my views might, in the end, differ with theirs, and to their credit offered me their assistance, encouragement, and direct access to the company archives. Nothing more. As an active spirits critic, I have grown intimately familiar with the bourbon and rye whiskies produced in abundance at their historic plant, which is now a celebrated landmark. As the research data unfolded over many months of examination, I became convinced that Buffalo Trace's history deserved to be told as much from the viewpoint of its low bank location on the Kentucky River as from the intriguing lives of the people who created the legendary bourbon and rye whiskies through the decades. The striking history of the distillery's site was, in my view, of paramount importance to the proper telling of the story. The tale of Buffalo Trace Distillery, I concluded early on, could not have occurred at any other place. Consequently, you will find that the initial chapters have little to do with the bubbling of fermenting grain mash or the boiling of the mash's low-strength beer into high-alcohol distillate. The opening of Buffalo Barrels and Bourbon, nearly a fifth of the narrative, instead deals with the stark realities endured by the robust 17th, 18th, and early 19th century Euro-American individuals who survived and persevered in the harsh but green and lush North American environment. In this case, the focus lies on the uncharted, heavily forested area described first in maps as Kentucky. While beguiling to the eye and imagination, the deceptively feral soul of Kentucky forced hundreds of the earliest explorers, surveyors, military scouts, trappers, and fur traders to their knees in bruised submission. At least it did for those fortunate ones who lived long enough to talk or write about it in journals. The land itself, where the Buffalo Trace Distillery campus stands today, is a listed member of the National Register of Historic Places, number 2,428, one of a mere 2,600 such sites in the United States. This location in north-central Kentucky is the beneficiary of a geological and topographical majesty that must have been breathtaking to the first Euro-Americans who hacked their way through the midnight-dark primeval forests and paddled their pirogues down the swirling currents of the Kentucky River. It is here where the layers of sedentary substrata, the karst shelf geology, the trough-like sandy bank, pure spring water, the fertile, arable land for the growing of corn, and the strategic proximity to a major waterway, the Ohio River, all merge to create an ideal situation in which to make whiskey. Over time, the spilt blood of the pioneers, the heinous trials endured by the Native American tribes, the near extinction of the dormant beasts of the Great Plains, the buffalo, converge to create this saga about the taming of this virgin region and later about the distilling of legendary American whiskey. After the low bank location was settled with the building of crude riverside log structures, the storyline changes into a narrative that centers upon the multiple generations of influential clans, such as the Lees, Swigerts, Taylors, Staggs, Blantons, and Van Winkles. Painted with the main characters' foibles, peccadilloes, aspirations, failures, ingenuity, courage, and triumphs, Buffalo Barrels and Bourbon then warps into the chapters that uncover the evolution of some of America's most beloved whiskies, the bourbons and rise of Buffalo Trace. The research and writing of this book took me back to places in time and space that I'd not visited to any significant degree for some years. It was grand to be immersed once again in the racehorse and whiskey fables of Kentucky's bluegrass district. If bourbon whiskey is, as many believe, America's hallmark spirit, Kentucky is its cradle, its ancestral place of origin, its soul and vibrant inspiration. F. Paul Pakholt, Hudson Valley, New York, Spring 2021. 1. This river runs north, west, and out of ye westerly side. The exact spot on which the story of Buffalo Trace Distillery begins is in the northern reaches of the Commonwealth of Kentucky, known as Bluegrass, the verdant region immediately south of the state of Ohio. This location, whose precise coordinates are 38.2167 degrees north, 84.8709 degrees west, is ordinary by most mid-continental topographical standards. It is just a low, dipping bank, a sandy crossing point along the serpentine Kentucky River. However, since the late 20th century, this site has become a hallowed destination for whiskey lovers, specifically because of the present-day distillery, its engrossing history, and its acclaimed roster of award-winning rye and bourbon whiskeys. To best set the stage with regard to this point on the North American map and its recent occupant, it is necessary to first time travel back 11,500 to 12,000 years to the cold, bleak conclusion of planet Earth's Pleistocene epoch. This frigid period was the bracing remnant, an echo of the Northern Hemisphere's last great ice age. North America's two towering blue-tinted glaciers, the Laurentide that lay east of the Mississippi River and the Cordilleran that lay to the river's west, were slowly receding northward into Canada. In their wake, the glaciers, at some points 2 miles thick, left great swaths of hardwood forests, carved river valleys, and fathomless glacial lakes, grassy pastures, and vast, desolate, and arid plains. Archaeologists postulate that as long ago as 9,500 to 8,000 BCE, before Common Era, the hunter-gatherer ancestors of today's Native Americans were already active in the area of North America that encompasses parts of the present-day states of Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Tennessee, Missouri, West Virginia, New York, Virginia, and Kentucky. Geologists refer to this distinct area as the Salina Basin, a sprawling region south of the Great Lakes that is rich in deep layers of minerals and rock salt deposits. Tribal histories point out that the Native Americans utilized salt as a condiment. In the slowly warming environmental conditions of the period, the small nomadic groups of indigenous hunters became skilled in stalking big game, including mammalian behemoths like the woolly mammoth, bison, short-faced bear, dire wolf, ground sloth, and mastodon. Other predators included smilodons, the huge and ferocious genus of saber-toothed cats that without fuss or hesitation efficiently preyed on all mammals, including the era's scrawny but swift and clever Homo sapiens, Latin wise man. During the same period, a fateful North American event called the Pleistocene megafauna extinction occurred. In the relatively brief span of hundreds of years, as many as 90 genera of megafauna, that group of large mammals weighing more than 100 pounds, vanished due to a docket of still speculative reasons. These possible causes included the gyrations in global climate as the Earth incrementally warmed, evolving terrain due to volcanic or seismic activity, widespread drought, overhunting by the increasingly adept and resourceful Aboriginal tribes, and perhaps most spectacularly, the yet-to-be-discovered impact of an asteroid. Though major annihilations of plant, insect, and animal life have regularly occurred throughout the annals of Earth's history, no overwhelming body of evidence points to a single cause of such an extreme destruction of large mammals as the Pleistocene era closed. Most likely, this mass elimination happened due to a confluence of two or more of the cited causes. One result of significant note, however, involves one member of the Pleistocene megafauna that somehow survived this cataclysmic event, the rugged bison. With the heating up of North America's climate through the Archaic period of 8,000 to 1,000 BCE, conditions in the Salina Basin region became more tolerable for the growing numbers of native peoples who populated the bluegrass. Critically, fresh water was plentiful in the area presently known as Kentucky, as were big game and freshwater fish. The northwesterly flowing Kentucky and Licking rivers and their tributaries, along with cold water springs, sinkholes, lakes, and ponds, formed through crevices in the karst or limestone ridge known as the Cincinnati Arch, created an accommodating habitat in which flora, fauna, and the hunter-gatherer native peoples could survive. In the 2,000-year period that is known as the Woodland Period, from 1,000 BCE to 1,000 CE, Common Era, the social structure of the tribal populace grew more complex as more permanent communities and residential compounds, some based on primitive agriculture, began to be established. pottery and basket weaving became important skills and cultural emblems that defined tribal identities. The cultivation of crops centered mostly on the three sisters of Pan-American agriculture: beans, squash, and maize, also known as Indian corn, but also included the seasonal growing of amaranth, sunflower, and tobacco. By 450 BCE, the tribe started to build burial mounds in northern Kentucky, signaling another characteristic of a community-oriented society and the conclusion, at least in part, of nomadic lifestyles. The intersecting river system of the Bluegrass provided convenient highways by bark canoe or dugout that promoted intertribal trade and the movement between the Shawnee, Cherokee, Chickasaw, Wyandot, Delaware, Mosopilea, and Uchi hunting camps. Once the Americas were pried open by the voyages of Christopher Columbus in the 1490s, European monarchs rushed to gain footholds in the exotic continents to the west for the express purpose of mining their untapped natural resources, in particular gold, silver, and beaver furs, and to claim territory for the expansion of their kingdoms. Spain and Portugal were especially active in exploration throughout the 16th century. Their aggressive exploits caused deep concern in the courts of their main commercial and military rivals, England and France. Then in 1607, a century prior to the formation of the Kingdom of Great Britain, three vessels, sailing under the flag of England, launched at what is now coastal Virginia. They were members of the Chartered Virginia Company. Their mission was to create a colony, to be christened Jamestown, in North America for the English monarch King James I. Jamestown's harrowing struggles with famine, disease, and bitter clashes with the Algonquin tribe are widely known. In 1609, James I proclaimed the vast expanse of lands northwest and west of Virginia, that included the area that would later become Kentucky, as the property of the royal colony. With that event, as well as earlier incursions by the French and Spanish, the days of the eastern native tribes' reign became numbered. In the latter half of the 17th century, initial forays from Spanish and French Jesuit priests, trappers, and explorers like Robert de La Salle, Jacques Marquette, and Louis Joliet deep into the North American heartland had already taken place. From 1650 to 1675, expeditions led by Euro-American colonists from Virginia and North Carolina, traveling as far west as the Mississippi River, passed through northern Kentucky, provoking the native tribes. A remarkably vivid letter, written on August 22, 1674, at Fort Henry in colonial Virginia, by fur trader Colonel Abraham Wood to London-based investor John Richards, described in startling detail the expeditions of two explorers, James Needham and Gabriel Arthur, Wood's servant. 10 jam-packed pages of derring do chronicle their exploits over the course of 2 years, depicting with aching clarity the severity of the trials posed by such ventures of the period. Colonel Wood, in April 1673, commissioned Needham and Arthur to venture into the wild regions west of the Virginia and Carolina colonies in order to reach a trade agreement with the Cherokee tribe. The letter addresses how the men killed many swine, sturgeon, and beavers and barbecued them. It spoke of Needham and Arthur's numerous tense encounters with the suspicious native tribes. In one intriguing passage, Wood speaks of how "this river runs northwest, and out of ye westerly side it goeth, another great river about a day's journey lower, where the inhabitants are an innumerable company of Indians." It is clear from the report that Needham and Arthur's travels covered a wide range of territory that lay directly to the west of the Virginia and North Carolina colonies. The language suggests that their journeys might have included northern Kentucky, where two rivers, the Kentucky and the Licking, run in a northwesterly direction. James Needham unfortunately came to a horrific end at the hands of a tribal warrior and guide called Akanichi Indian John, a fat, thick, bluff-faced fellow who reportedly first shot Needham near ye burr of ye ear after a heated day-long disagreement. He then hacked open Needham's chest with a tomahawk, ripped out his heart, and held it aloft for all his companions to see. Wood's account of James Needham's death reported, Ye Tomahitans started to rescue Needham, but Indian John was too quick for them. So died the heroic Englishman. Arthur barely survived the violence, ending up first as a captive, but later a trusted companion of the tribal chief of the native band referred to by Wood as the Tomahitans, more commonly known as Cherokees. After being wounded in the arm from an arrow, taking part in war party raids on Spanish settlements in Florida, and marrying a Tomahitan woman named Hannah Rebecca Nikitia, Gabriel Arthur eventually returned to Fort Henry on June 18, 1674, after roving back and forth through what is now Kentucky, Alabama, Georgia, Florida, and Tennessee over the course of nearly two nerve-wracking years. Abraham Wood's commercial ambitions in the frontier ceased with James Needham's demise and Gabriel Arthur's final return. Yet even facing such horrors, exploratory penetrations into the western frontier continued unabated and were often underwritten by companies like the Ohio Company of Virginia, the Illinois and Wabash Land Company, and the Ohio Land Company. The explorers, surveyors, traders, trappers, blacksmiths, carpenters, and hunters of the pre-American Revolutionary War period who journeyed westward over the crags of the Blue Ridge and Appalachian mountain chains to trek into the inhospitable environs of the Ohio River Valley were intrepid, rugged, and determined individuals. A substantial number of adventurers who ventured into this desolate region in the 17th and 18th centuries were never seen or heard from again. Others, either broken in spirit or maimed by bear claw or arrowhead or copperhead snake, returned chastened to the safety of the 13 Atlantic coast-hugging American colonies that were by the 1760s ruled by King George III, monarch of Great Britain. Their quests and dreams, as documented by volumes of existing accounts, often ended in defeat, ill health, or financial ruin. The taverns of Philadelphia, the beer halls of Boston, and the inns of Richmond served as the theaters in which the defeated travelers recounted their bedeviled wanderings. They spun bone-chilling tales of starvation, of lost fingers and toes to frostbite, of impenetrable forests, of lethal midnight attacks by panthers or feral pigs, and most frightening of all, their gruesome encounters with hunting and war parties of native tribes. Such was the misfortune for some after being subdued by the harsh rigors of the unforgiving western wilderness. By stark contrast, the more successful returning wayfarers from the frontier came back to the colonies in triumph, brandishing bundles of animal pelts, the scars of hair-raising escapades, and unbridled hubris. With infectious gusto, they reported to mesmerized colonial audiences about a limitless, fertile Garden of Eden-like paradise that, yes, tested any sane person's deepest inner resources and nerve, but likewise offered to those blessed with a surfeit of metal the potential reward of witnessing virgin, uncharted lands on which to hunt and fish and perhaps, in time, to cultivate and settle. One later report, carried by the Courier-Journal of Louisville on September 9, 1888, that focused on the escapades of one family, the McAfee clan, stated, "The glowing description given of the country beyond the mountains by Dr. Thomas Walker and other adventurous spirits inspired the younger members of the McAfee family with enthusiasm and a burning desire to visit it and judge of its beauties for themselves." The McAfee explorations would, as we shall hear, prove to be of key importance to our story. After a century, 1670 to 1770, of steady immigration from Europe and the subsequent development of quiet hamlets into bustling towns, many mid-18th century citizens of the British Crown thought the king's most prized colonies had become too crowded and too overfarmed. In the minds of some colonists, the New World had become too much like the Old World of England, Scotland, Ireland, Wales, Holland, Sweden, Switzerland, or Germany, the places they had left behind. Though 90% of the colonists during that period were farmers, the desire of the restless and the disgruntled to push westward into the fabled region the British called Indian Reserve became a clarion call in churches, taverns, and meeting halls from the late 1690s into the first half of the 1700s. By the 1750s and 1760s, the focus of further colonial exploration had turned to locating suitable regions for settlement. The lushness of the bluegrass held particular attraction to the surveyors. One notable surveyor, Christopher Gist, wrote in 1751 with evident excitement that he approached the Kentucky River. "From the top of the mountain we saw fine level country southwest as far as our eyes could behold, and it was a clear day." Of his movements the next day, Gist wrote, "At about 12 miles came to the Cutaway, Kentucky River. We were obliged to go up it about 1 mile to an island which was the shoalest place we could find to cross at." Gist's chronicled movements suggest that the crossing he describes might be at the very location later to be called Leestown, that lay about 1 mile from present-day Frankfort and was a critical part of the famed ancient Buffalo Trail, referred to by the native tribes as Great Buffalo Trace. The amazement, the terror. Aside from the empty vastness and developmental potential of the western wilderness, one common impression communicated by the returning frontiersmen, especially the celebrated long hunters like Daniel and Squire Boone, Henry Skaggs, James Herod, Isaac Bledsoe, Richard Callaway, and others involved their stirring first-hand accounts of the breathtaking numbers of big game creatures. Elk, white-tailed deer, black bear, panther, beaver, bobcat, wolf, wolverine, wild boar, and bison reigned supreme in the frontier's dense woodlands, bogs, limestone outcroppings, plains, and meadows. Even allowing for the seasonal hunting by the regional tribes, big game populations of unimaginable sizes flourished in the region that now encompasses all or part of the heartland states of Kentucky, Tennessee, Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, and Illinois. But of all the recorded accounts concerning big game, the most indelible impressions were spun courtesy of the horned, cocoa brown colored, and aggressive American bison. Zoology long ago determined that the two distinct varieties of buffalo in the greater bovid family had for millennia been found solely in sub-Saharan Africa, the ornery and dangerous Cape buffalo, and southeastern Asia, the water buffalo, and not in North America until relatively recently. Buffalo and bison are related, but biologically different. DNA findings from bones excavated in northern Canada suggest, however, that bison herds immigrated from eastern Asia anywhere from 195,000 to 130,000 years ago, traveling over the natural Bering Straits land bridge that connected eastern Asia to Alaska. The buffalo cousins that made the journey, two bovid families of bison, are divided between the American bison and the European bison. Nevertheless, the English and French-speaking explorers of the western frontier, from their initial 17th-century portrayals, referred to the American bison by a variety of names, including biffalo, B-I-F-F-A-L-O, buffalo, B-O-F-E-L-O, buffalo, B-U-F-F-A-L-O-W, buffalo, B-U-F-F-L-O, buffalo, B-U-F-F-A-L-O-E, and most commonly, buffalo, B-U-F-F-A-L-O. That latter sobriquet, though technically incorrect, has endured to the present day. In keeping with this quirky custom, I will refer to the American bison as buffalo moving forward. In terms of individual size, the North American buffalo is an imposing, sinewy, yet compact biological machine. Females average from 700 to 1,000 pounds, stand 5 feet at the shoulder, and are 6 to 7 feet from nose to tail, while males can tip the scales at 1,800 to 2,000 pounds, stand 6 feet at the shoulder, and span up to 9 feet in length. In their innate fight-or-flight genetic programming, the slightest disturbance while they are at rest or grazing can, in an instant, set an entire herd into unpredictable, helter-skelter motion from 0 to 30 miles per hour. This hair-trigger reflex is why Native American hunters, who regarded the buffalo as a sacred being, used so much caution, stealth, and concealing costumes when in the hunt. Their elaborate precautions taught the Euro-American long hunters and their successors about the necessity for extreme safeguard measures when dealing with the skittish buffaloes. The Euro-American explorers encountered buffalo not only in small groups of 20 to 50, but also in vast herds in the tens of thousands.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?